Good evening, everyone. Welcome, everyone, to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. It's great to see some new faces here, and a little bird told me we have some Midwestern State students all the way from Wichita Falls. Is that right? Okay. Thank you guys for taking the time to drive in for our presentation. And great to see some other new faces. For those of you not familiar with the program, we'll have a speaker for about 45 to 60 minutes and then reserve a little bit of time for Q&A at the end. So save your questions to the end, and then we'll recognize questioners one at a time until not come back for seconds until everybody's had a chance for a question. And try to keep it in the form of a question if you can, and not a sermon. We'll try to enforce that. And we are a nonprofit, all volunteer organization, but we do have certain expenses such as publicity, website, printing, etc. And so we do pick up a $5 admission fee. Or if you want to become a regular subscriber, you can get for $30. $35. You can get a 6-month subscription, which is pretty close to half price. That's about all the administrative announcements I could think, so I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. Tonight we have Mr. John Beazley with us. Mr. Beazley was born in England and educated at London's Imperial College of Science and Technology with a PhD in applied physics, and then later obtained an MBA at the University of Dallas here locally. John worked for several years in industrial research at General Electric and ICL, both in London, and came to the United States in 1968, being recruited by the Xerox Corporation, for which he was continued employment for over 20 years. John spent the last 10 years of his active career as a consultant in the expanding telecommunications industry in Dallas, now retired, and these are his own words, looking after a mini real estate empire. So I'd like to introduce you to Mr. John Beazley.
Well, apparently I'm hooked up. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
You might have some questions about my English later on. I have to translate it to Texican. Tonight I'm going to talk about capitalism, how great thou art. That has the religious connotation. Although I must say, when we came in newly married in 1968, came here, and it really was wonderful. Everybody was working. It was amazingly cheap to live. We thought it was really... As I say, we thought it was wonderful. How great the art has a religious connotation, because looking at America in the 50s, capitalism became a sort of state religion. Basically, it was capitalism, American capitalism, in competition with godless communism. In 1954, of course, the Pledge of Allegiance was modified to add the words "One Nation Under God." And in 1957, "In God We Trust" appeared on the banknote. So, capitalism and God seem to run hand in hand. In truth, I think capitalism was and really is nothing to do with God. It's basically an economic construct. And it's actually a man-made construct. You can have, it's really a system that can be modified and changed. In fact, has been changed. What I would say is that capitalism has really changed in the last 30 years and has lost most of its ethical values and even moral values. And I think it needs to get back both ethical and moral values. And what I would say, this living in an era of what I call the grand masquerade. It's a masquerade is commonplace everywhere. For example, we have TV evangelists masquerading as Christians. We have politicians masquerading as Homo sapiens. We have the political system masquerading as a democracy. And as you know, we have the best democracy money can buy. We have financial fraudsters in the city of London and in Wall Street masquerading as banksters, as bankers.
Yeah,
and we have the economic system masquerading as capitalism. Now, basically, today's capitalism doesn't work. Adam Smith, the architect of what I call initial liberal capitalism, wouldn't recognize this as a capitalist system. Because basically speaking, we do not have a free market, we do not have free trade, and we do not have competition. What he wouldn't recognize the system as is a pre-capitalism. That's to say, in the 13th and 18th century in England, we had mercantilism. That's to say, we had cartels. So we had the cartels granted by the king as a permit to operate across the globe. And basically, that's what we have today. We have huge multinationals operating as cartels. In fact, of the 100 richest, wealthiest entities in the world, including countries, over 50 are multinational corporations. They basically are moving on to control everything. Governments, they look at the world devoid of states, which they don't care about. They control the world organization. And they basically control trade and so on. So that's what we move back to, the cartel system. So now in this, so here we are in this basically cartel system. So this is, as I say, an economic construct. Now, what really do we want from a capitalist system? Well, I'm saying that this system as is really not fit for purpose. So what is the purpose? Well, generally speaking, I'd say that an economic system should provide a decent standard of living for everybody, and the system should pay its way in the world. So those two things, I think most people would say, are pretty reasonable. But do we? What are we doing in those two objectives? Well, the first thing to look at is the standard of living. Now, up until 1980 in America, the mean income kept pace with the gross national product. Since 1980, that has fallen away. In fact, the current family median income is about $61,000 a year. Now, if that kept pace with the growth in the GNP, it would be $92,000 a year. So there's been a 50% drop off. This is seen, and I see it because I run a mini real estate empire, so I meet lots of people, and I'm in the low end of the business, so, and things are very, very tough out there. Very tough. And certainly in New York City, $11,000 a year is certainly not a living wage for anybody. Now, what we've seen is, one of the saddest things, really, is we've done a disservice to our young, really. When graduates come out of college owing a huge debt, have to, in fact, pay to work with these unpaid internships. And in England, we have now called zero-hour contracts. In fact, pre-war conditions have come back. You have a contract to work, but there's no guarantee of any hours. It can be 0, 10, 20, anything. And that's what the young have to put up with. Now, to me, that's totally unacceptable. like it's light flashing.
Well, I'll turn back on.
Right. Now, in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel has announced that Europeans must lower their standard of living in order to compete in the international marketplace. Well, that's good news, isn't it, folks? I like that. Mm. So, and in general, I think the workplace has become more uncertain and stressful. So it's not a pleasant place to be anymore. I mean, people really don't get a lot of enjoyment in working in such an atmosphere like that. So that's really the standard of living. We're more stressed out, especially at the lower ebb of things. And I suppose we would say there's a deficit in ethical and moral values for that situation. So what about paying our way in the world? Where is the U.S. doing that? Well, we've had a trade deficit every year since 1978. Of course, the huge increase has happened since China was admitted to the World Trade Organization in 2000. The cumulative total trade deficit is something like $10 trillion. Roughly half of that is by foreign owners owning American assets, and the other half is in treasuries. And as you know, for example, China is now busily buying up American business. For example, the AMC movie chain is owned by the Chinese, and this will continue. This will continue. Now, in Adam Smith's World of Economics, investment equals savings. So what people save is then invested. Now, those of you schooled in multinational economics would realize that investment equals savings minus the current account. So what is the current account? Well, it's the trade deficit plus all the other money flows that go out of America. So how big is that? Well, investment, because of this current account deficit, is reduced by about 30%. So America has not reduced its investment by 30%, but the $1 trillion had to be made up by borrowing. So this situation cannot continue. You cannot run a trade deficit year after year. And the Chinese won't go on buying American bonds year after year. And if these clowns in Washington don't get their act together, then and default on paying those interest on treasury bonds, I think the roof will fall in. Because why would I put money in a bank and then the bank won't pay me? I mean, it's not. So all in all, I'm saying this, the country is not paying its way in the world, and you have a declining living standard. So basically speaking, I'm saying the system as is not fit for purpose. So, but beyond that, we have ethical problems with this economic system. I suppose it's too much to expect moral values from an economic system, but I think we should have some more values, and I'll get to that later. So what we've seen, any system, economic system, capitalist system, must have ethical standards in the various professions that support it. For example, what we've seen is a total violation of standards in banking, in accounting, auditing, legal system, insurance, rating agencies, pension oversight, and mortgage companies. Basically, make them corrupted. So the U.S. in the U.S. the scandals going back to Enron, WorldCom, Nationwide, and the scandals go on. More recently, Chase Bank has been manipulating the energy prices. And Goldman Sachs has been manipulating what's called the metals financing system through the London Metal Exchange. So the price of metals has gone up because the finance to move the metals out of the warehouses has slowed down. So we've seen a grand manipulation of commodities. So that's why you see food prices shoot up and down. About on the Chicago Commodities Exchange, roughly 80% of all trades are speculative. However, you know, basically, the start of this ethical lapse, you might say, started in London, 1986. It was what was called the Big Bang. That was when Thatcher's government decided to deregulate finance. Because Britain had never had an SEC, never had financial control. So Thatcher's philosophy of laissez-faire gave way to no regulation. And successive governments, including so-called New Labour, boasted that there was light-touch regulation. So, of course, all the financial criminals of the world went to London. So, as you say, there was no SEC, no Sarbanes, Oxley, nothing. So what happened was that in my youth, you had the city gentleman, and you'd go pinstripe trousers and a bowler hat. And they came from the upper echelons of society. And the word was, my word is my bond. You shake hands and that was it. Now it's become, I'll cheat you if I can. So we've seen scandal after scandal. We've seen the LIBOR interest rigging. We've seen money laundering, mis-selling of financial products, exorbitant fees, and pension plan rip-offs. In fact, Joe Cassano, who was head of finance for AIG, operated out of London. And that basically was a precursor to the crash, financial crash. So really, the conclusion one has is that this atmosphere of laissez-faire degraded all standards, both ethical and so on. And there was no power of competition to push back on this. It's because basically now in America you've got, three or four big banks. I mean, they're oligopolies. There's not free market competition. So, that's the situation. So that's sort of an overview of where we are. What I said in my bio and the preamble that I focus on two salient characteristics of the current corporate world to see where we are. And those two characteristics I'm focus on tonight are capital formulation and hierarchical control. Both of which I think are effective. Capital formation. Now, as you all may know, the Industrial Revolution started in England in the late 17th, 18th century. And so we had, along with that, we had the economic theorists. We had David Hume, Adam Smith, David Ricardo. They laid down the classical economic theory. Now, we had the formation of larger and larger industrial companies. Now, we had investors, let's say, rich individuals who wanted to invest in the industrialization enterprises, but not actually working. So they set up a system, I think, a board of directors to look after their interests and oversee the CEO and the officers of the company. But they always demanded liquidity. That's to say, they always wanted to get their money out. So that's why you had stock markets, so they could get out quickly. So from the very start, ownership was really a temporary basis. Now in today's world, we have ownership on a remarkably temporary basis. The other year, I think it was 2011, the average ownership of the stock was 22 seconds. So these people are not owners. They're not investors. They're purely speculators. They really don't care about the underlying operation of the company they supposedly invest in. They're merely interested in the volatility of the market. Now that we have these huge banks, who really are nothing more than hedge funds, and after the repeal of the Glass-Steagall, they have control of the entire, most of the entire money supply. So they can jerk the markets about. The other year I was following a stock called A&R coal stock. So one week it went up, next week it went down, up, down. If you followed the up down, you'd have doubled your money in a month. So the market, so-called market, the interest of the people is really in volatility. They make their money by volatility. They're not interested in a stable situation. In a stable situation, you don't make money. So the characters on Wall Street are jigging the market up and down all the time. Now, how can that be? Well, let's look at how you value a share. Now, what you do is a share is calculated by its present value. That's to say, you take the interest rate and then you estimate the future income stream. And using that income stream, you bring that value back to the present day. And that's the value of a share. So let's look at that. I mean, its future income stream, well, you know, good luck, you know. And the interest rate is being manipulated. So really, it's a figment. The value of a share is a figment. That's why it can be manipulated. You know, one day the president sneezes, oh my, it's bad, sell. A few days later, a few weeks later, say, well, things aren't so bad, buy. So really what you've got is something that's just not real, not on any economic sense. And so really, when you talk about the market, the financial market, and the whole thing, it just does not hold logically together. On the other hand, and interestingly enough, 2008 was the year of the great short. As I say, you can sell a stock short. If it goes down, you buy it back and you make money. Now, 2007, Christopher Cox, who was chairman of the SEC, he cited the famous 1933 uptick rule should be repealed. It was not needed. Now, what was the uptick rule? Well, FDR created, as part of the financial regulation, the uptick rule, which said you could only short a stock if the market was going up. So naturally, in these engineered recessions that happen every eight years, those in the know knew that you have a fantastic crash in 2008. So now that you didn't have the uptick rule, you could short that market all the way down. And of course, as we know, it dropped in half. So, as I say, what we've seen is every 8 years, roughly since the early 80s, we've seen a crash in the market. These aren't accidental happenings. They're engineered happenings. Because, as I said, the market manipulators like volatility. So you have day-to-day volatility, but in these big crashes, you have huge volatility. So but this volatility, as I say, is very damaging to an economy, because most businesses want stable conditions. For example, the building trade gets really whipsawed by ups and downs in this market. You can't really keep a stable labor force, and so on. So the other aspect which is that companies can be easily taken over by foreign concerns, and now you've got these huge sovereign wealth funds. And America funding this deficit will see more and more of its interests taken over. That is exactly what has happened in England. Over half of England's companies are now foreign owned. For example, Kraft took over Cadbury's chocolate maker, moved factories to Poland, moved corporate headquarters to Zug, Switzerland. So not only did England lose a factory and working, but also the tax base. And that is happening in England almost every couple of weeks. Another company has taken over. The other notion is that economic theorist that the market correctly allocates funds. This is very efficient to talk about. In fact, the market completely misallocates funds because we have these glorious bubbles. Now, I'll reference a book I wrote later, but the first miscreant was a character, a Scotsman called John Law, a few centuries back in France. But of course, in the 90s, we had the dot-com bubble, the first, and we had, in the aughties, we had the housing market, the bubble. Now, these bubbles are obviously when they happen, but they're not controlled, but it's part and parcel of this stock market system. It's in the very nature of the beast. So, my predilection is that funding should be much more related to bonds, because bonds are bought, it's much more stable, you have a fixed income stream and a fixed payment at the end. Now, in fact, the bond market is much bigger than the share market by a factor of 4 to 5. So really, the share market seems to wag the financial the dog, which in my mind it should. So that's really the problem of finance, really, and the share market. So hierarchical control. This has to do with the boss at the top and the workers at the bottom. Well, what's happened is that we don't really have owners anymore. We have shareholders. So basically, the CEO is in charge of the whole thing. He selects the board of directors, the compensation committee, and he basically rewards himself as he sees fit. Because there's nobody really looking after these so-called shareholders. So basically, back I think 40 years ago, they decided to issue stock options purportedly to align the interests of the company or the corporate stockholders with the performance of the company. So now we have super extravagant CEO pay. Basically speaking, the lowest poor chap earns $7.25 an hour, and at the highest end you've got $5,000 an hour. Now, of course, in 2012, I think the richest paid American was the chairman of United Healthcare, $100 million a year. Now, as I say, I'd love to meet him. He must be the biggest genius the world has ever seen. I haven't really seen a lot of intellect at the top of corporations, and I've worked inside a lot of them. And I do know intellect. In Imperial, where I went to college, we had four Nobel Prize people, the winners in the physics department, so I've seen intellect at work. Silicon Valley, 80% of the compensation is in options. And the banking bonuses are 4 times the value paid out in dividends. Essentially, these people at the top are looting the company. Let's talk about two typical heroes, of which I have some personal experience, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates.
Now, I joined the Xerox in 1968. In the early 70s, Xerox decided that the world would be paperless, that people won't use copiers anymore. So they established Palo Alto Research Lab. They had the money in those days. They hired the best technical people they could find. But out of Park came Windows, the mouse, object-oriented code, local area networks, came the Word, which and so on. Now, Steve Jobs was invited to see this. So whereas Xerox management didn't put much value on it, Steve Jobs realized right away what this technology was and how it could be used. So that's where Apple Computer came from, straight out of Park. Bill Gates also was slow to get the Windows. I was on a team, a group of a few people. We went out to Microsoft and met personally with Steve Ballmer. We handed over the specifications of Windows to Microsoft. So Xerox really gave away family silver. and that's the way it goes. But now these people out of that became billionaires. So that's what happens. Now in the hedge fund, as I say, bankers have paid, the banking system, major banks become hedge funds. They've created 10 in this run up in the before the big crash. 10 billionaires were created from these hedge fund operations. So my take is the banking system as it is really an extractor of wealth rather than a creator of wealth. And what we really need is creators of wealth. We don't need extractors. So basically what the CEOs do to, they want to pump up the stock price and gain their options and so on. Their take is, we'll cut costs, we'll reduce benefits, and we'll transfer the costs as much to the public as much as possible. And so in 2008, for example, once the crash began, of course, there was about a 10% reduction in hours across the board in America. Now, 10% reduction in income is about $2 trillion taken out of the economy, so it's not surprising that the economy tanked. And of course, 70% of the economy is driven by consumer spending. So, of course, we've had talk about the 99% and the 1%, but basically the 1% have not done too badly. Their wealth in 2012 went up by over 11%. The 1% wealth went down by a couple of percent. So is it like the Bush doctrine? Well, Karl Rove, we must give tax breaks to the rich because they fund things. So where does their wealth actually go? When it goes into stocks, bonds, real estate, gold, painting, it really rarely goes to productive investment. And a lot of it goes to this magical land called offshore. Now let's talk about offshore. In 1962, Dean Acheson, who was at one time Secretary of State, announced that Great Britain has lost an empire and has yet to find a role. Well, it was not 5 years too late in his observations. It had found a role. Basically speaking, he didn't understand the workings of the City of London. Now, the City of London is a square mile financial district. Now, I laugh when I told my friend this, but let's go back to 1066. So you say, well, what happened in England? Well, that was the last time England was successfully invaded by William the Conqueror. Now, William the Conqueror owned everything. Not his barons and knights, but the Domesday Book was a compendium of everything he owned. Now, the one square mile he didn't own was the city of London. Why was that? Well, as you know from Shakespeare's tragedies, the king was always dependent on money. So you don't fool with the money boys. In fact, Lyndon, I heard a talk by somebody from Lyndon LaRouche operation who said, well, the Queen of England, you know, is masterminding this grand conspiracy. Well, it turns out that when the Queen goes to the Mansion House, which is in the middle of the city of London, the Mayor of London meets her, and only by his permission is she let in. So where does that take us? Well, what happened in 1957, that's 5 years before Acheson made a statement, Europe was awash with euro dollars. So the city of London began to trade in euro dollars and fund American corporations and so on and so forth. In 1979, capital controls ended. And as they say, in 1986, the Big Bang happened, which meant you had electronic funds transferred. So money could zip across the world at the touch of a button. So now, as I explained, we have these cartels, Apple being one. So their operations mainly are in this offshore world, which is British control. This offshore world basically is the remnants of the British Empire, the Channel Islands, Bermuda, British Virgin Islands, and so on. To understand the depth of it, 14% of the investment in China came from the British Virgin Islands. Only 4% actually came from America itself last year. Offshore, there's a wonderful construct. Basically, it's tax-free. If you're an American entrepreneur, cartel operator, you can go to accountant lawyers in London. They will set you up with a trust or a corporation in the British Virgin Islands. And you'll have proxies running it for you. Your name will never appear on that company. So basically, you can funnel your wealth, a la Mitt Romney, to an entity in this offshore world, and then you're off to the races. You can have investments around the world, real estate around the world, and the tax man will never bother you because he doesn't know you're there. And that all came out of London, in this famous offshore world. So as I say, that's where the cartels operate. And for example, Apple Operations International has got about 100 million offshore. The total money offshore is estimated to be something like 20 trillion. So the federal deficit is, my calculation, the growth is impacted by about 1% a year. So as I say, we need entrepreneurs, we don't need investors in offshore world. We need to get America back to work. We need to help our young people. So this situation is just unsatisfactory, totally. So a great achievement of Thatcher was privatization. And that involved both private stock and hierarchical control. But basically, privatization, as it goes, is really a theft of public assets. The top civil servants become instant millionaires, and you get monopoly profits. And basically, the most ludicrous things happen. For example, New Labour, under Tony Blair, one of the biggest charlatans in the political firmament, in my opinion, nationalised the London Fire Brigade. Privatised the London Fire Brigade. It was bought up by a hedge fund. A year ago, the hedge fund went broke, and it was sold to another hedge fund for £1. So what's the interest in the London Fire Brigade? Well, it has fire brigade buildings. And now there's talk about reducing the number of fire brigade buildings. And then you can turn these buildings into luxury apartments. And if you wanted to buy an apartment overlooking Hyde Park, you'd have to pull into your back pocket and pull out £50 to £100 million. So that's the attraction of privatization of public assets. Basically, in England, the water companies are owned by the Germans, the power company owned by the French, almost nothing is owned by England anymore. And that's the future of this country if it goes on the way it's going. You won't own a thing. And you won't know it's happening. So, what do we need to do? What would I recommend to do? Well, I'd say that, look, financial system, the economic system, is nothing more than a construct. It's man-made, so let's change it. So the first thing to say, we need a coordinated economic policy. So what would be the objectives of this? Well, we'd like no unemployment. And by the way, in England, under Keynesian, in the 50s and 60s, the unemployment, average unemployment, 1.6%. America's never achieved that. At its best, America achieves 5%. Well, that's 8 million poor unemployed. Now, you students of Karl Marx, know that his statement was that the capitalist system always gives the appearance of a surplus population. Well, that's his 8 million unemployed. Well, really speaking, it's never, not only 8 million, but 5%. It's more like 12 million. And right now we have 20 million. And of course, the politicians will say, well, we can't afford to do this, we can't afford to do that, we must cut back. But we can afford to have 20 million people unemployed, unproductive. Now that, to me, is an economic failure. We need everybody working productively that wants to work. That's what we need to do, especially for our young people. So look around you folks, I mean, it's our generation that's let down our young people. So knowing that, so we want low unemployment, reasonable growth, low inflation, managed trade, managed business cycles, and social cohesion. And throwing in, we'd love to have some moral values. So we need actually, when you run an economy, there are two aspects of the economy. There's the monetary policy and the fiscal policy. The monetary policy right now is controlled by the Fed, and that controls interest rates and the money supply. Fiscal policy is controlled by the politicians, and that's public spending. Now, right now, we have a total mismatch between that. The Fed now has this quantitative easing, which is trying to boost the economy, where in truth, we needed a massive stimulus. The $800 billion stimulus was not enough. Larry Summers nixed the $1.6 trillion that Christine Wilmer recommended to Obama. So you need to run the two together. You can't really have two separate deals going. So my proposal is we do away with the Fed controlling this and the Treasury. We have one institution manned by an institute of economists that say, okay, this is our money supply needs. Of course, it grows with the population. And this is the amount of money we can spend by the government. And by the way, you know, so it takes a reasonable proportion to build infrastructure and run the things that the government builds. Now, I'm not an advocate in interfering with business. But government has a real place in the world. There are things that only governments can do. And so they must be funded. But that money, the amount of money out of the GNP would be set by this independent body. because the Federal Reserve really is nothing more than a group. It's owned by the banks, and it exists to prop up the banks. And for example, in 1998, there was this hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management, naturally headquartered in the Cayman Islands, that went bust. It was a hedge fund partnership for high net worth individuals. It was founded by Robert Merton from MIT, Myron Scholes from Stanford, and interestingly, David Mullins, who was vice chair of the Fed. So they got involved in bond market arbitrage, and the whole thing crashed. So the Fed stepped in with the Treasury and bailed it out to the tune of $4 billion. Now that is really socialism for the rich, by any definition. You know, if I invested in a stock and it went broke, I don't think the Fed would rush in to bail me out. And of course we had the TARP plan, which was really, should be called the Troubled Bankers Relief Fund. So the bankers were bailed out. Basically, they all went broke. And so the Fed stepped in to refund them by this process of what's so-called quantitative easing, that is, shoveling money. Now, the banks were put back on their feet, but the general economy wasn't. I mean, small businesses can't get loans. And basically, it's small businesses that are the engine of this whole economy. It's small business we want more of. We certainly don't need all these all-powerful banks. So we basically have the banks, this is this character I call Poor Joe Sixpack. I mean, Poor Joe Sixpack was fired from his job. He lost his health insurance, couldn't pay his mortgage, probably got divorced, but that's it. So the bankers got put back on their feet, but not Poor Joe Sixpack. He's probably still homeless, and they wish him well, right? So, the politicians, I mean, basically, Europe regards what's going on in Washington as infantile. That's been the adjective used. We've gone over the fiscal cliff, and we're just about to default on our national debt to paying interest on the treasuries and shut down the government to boot. Now, you know, that's not a way to run a country. So, as I say, we need a new system. We really do need to return to what I would call a proper capitalist system, where we do have free markets. We do have So we need to get out of the World Trade Organization, as was established by the international cartels, stop these trade deals, break up the cartels, and all the oligopolies. And on the books we have all these antitrust laws, but we've never implemented them, because competition really does drive down costs. And basically speaking, since the 80s. It's not the unions that have been driving up the costs. It's really the lack of competition. You basically had the monopoly capitalism. So now we need to reform the banking system, because they, as I say, they've become hedge funds. So what I would institute is a super Glass-Steagall. So I'm suggesting we have a three-tier banking system with an adjunct that I'll talk about later. So we go back to having commercial high street banks that are divorced from the investment banks. And they carry on as they did before the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. We'd have investment banks that are only allowed to invest in bonds. So all of our retirement money and insurance money would be in these investment banks. So they'd invest in real productive businesses. And then lastly, you'd have these casino banks that would be totally uninsured, because most of the money would be in either the commercial banks or the investment bank, very little money. It would be the wealthy people who want to be in these casino banks. The other thing we should do, which is to tackle the problem of trade deficit, is we need to go back to a gold standard. But it's not the gold standard the Tea Party have advocated. It's the gold standard that Lord Keynes advocated in 1944 at the Bretton Woods conference. Of course, he lost the argument with Harry Dexter White, so we have the gold standard of $35 an ounce, which was a disaster for America and it's a disaster for Great Britain. So what did Keynes propose? Well, he proposed the establishment of an international currency called the Bancor. Bank meaning bank, or being gold. So it's really bank gold. So in the current situation, how would it work? Well, it would force balanced trade. What would happen is that America would trade dollars into bancors and vice versa. So at the end of the year, of course, America would have a trade deficit. So dollars to bancor, so the dollar would reduce in value by 5%, and the renminbi, the Chinese currency, would go up by 5%. So gradually, over several years, the trade deficit would disappear because it would balance out. And that's what he proposed. So this would mean that the productive businesses would not find it profitable to ship jobs and technology overseas. And this country must retain its technological edge to stay afloat. And yet it's been given away. Other countries such as Germany and so on don't do that. France doesn't. The other thing we must do, so that's really what I would do in the economy. We would bring back business to America. Now we must reform how we treat people in this country. Work situation is not acceptable. And we have to resolve what I call this hierarchical structure with the top people just looting the companies. So I think the basic problem is America initially relied upon its natural resources. Like my wife is from Finland, and 1938 Finland was attacked by Russia. And so after the war, they had to pay reparations, and they gradually pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. But they focused on people, healthcare, education. And now if you look at the educational standards, I saw one today, in reading and numeracy, Japan ranks first, Finland ranks second. Now America is going to do the same for its people. The resources are, a country is really only as valuable as its people. That's its people. We have, the government's duty is to take care of its people. That's its foremost concern. So, essentially, we must reduce the human capital. We have to reduce the cost of healthcare and education. In Europe, typically, countries spend 7 or 8% of the gross national product in healthcare, and they cover everybody. There are various schemes, single payer, part private, part government, but basically that's the figure. America, it's about 17%. So America is paying twice as much of its product in healthcare as other developing countries. I mean, that's a fabulous waste of resources. It's very, very inefficient. Obamacare really will do something, but really won't solve the problem. Education, now, as we said earlier, education is just fabulously expensive and goes up every year. It's really become unsustainable. Now, you know, in England, when I was very, very few people went to college. My education was free. In Finland, it's free. Now, and yet it survives. I mean, I think there must be mud of it. We must go to things like internet teaching up through, because these courses are the same. They can be made much more efficient. Perhaps only postgraduate studies should be specialized in research institutions. The other thing, countries like Germany have a twin track education system, a vocational system, and an academic system, and both carry the same value. So, but also Germany has other things. When the economy crashes, they have what they call Kurzarbeit, which is short working. They actually fund companies to do training and so on and so forth. And Italy has other measures, and I'll get into that. The next thing is really a dogma of mine, which is basically speaking, there's no democracy unless you have economic democracy. So what do I mean by economic democracy? Well, I really mean employee ownership and management. Now, how would I institute that? Well, for $800 million, you could fund a national development bank that would work in conjunction with the Small Business Administration. So young people who wanted to start a business would be able to get funding to do so. And you'd say, well, my God, there'd be all these failures. Well, frankly, I'd rather spend money people starting and failing than rather spending money on people being unemployed. It's a far better spend of the money. Now, in England, we have one example of employee-owned companies. It's very famous. You'll hear my friend from England. His daughter and both son-in-law work for this company. It's called John Lewis. 80,000 employees. It's very well known. It outcompetes everybody on the high street. It's a department store and as a grocery store. And since the recession, it's really maintained its employment and in fact gained market share. Now Tesco, which is a grocery store, which is the leader, has just lost about 30% in income. So it's losing. So John Lewis competes with the high street successfully. But a more interesting company is the largest employee-owned company in the world. It's called Mondragon in Spain. Interesting history. It's in the Basque area of northeast Spain. In 1941, the bishop sent a priest to a vocational school in Basque country. 2 years later, he founded a technical school. In 1957, he chose 5 students to start a manufacturing business, paraffin heaters. Several years later, they founded a bank. From that bank, by the mid-60s, 30 associated companies had grown up. Now it has nearly 100,000 employees. They make white goods. They do software, they do construction, and they're even in consultation with the Steel Workers Union of America. And in this crash in Spain, they haven't laid anybody off. Spain now has 25% unemployment. 50% of the people, young people, are now unemployed. It's a disaster. So the European experiment driven by Germany basically was misconceived, didn't have a proper economic policy, and is a disaster. So now, the driving force behind Mondragon is the Catholic social teaching. It actually brings moral values into corporate life. And that was its driving ethos. In fact, the ratio of the earnings at the top to bottom, 6-1. So the lowest would earn 20,000 a year, highest paid 120,000 a year. Now, So those are things that I suggest we should do here. I would say instead of, we spent, 1.45 trillion in these wars, let's spend half that and start up a national development bank to start small businesses. Let's get America back to work. Let's give our young people a chance. Constitutional reform. Now, Americans are very proud of their constitution. England doesn't have one. I'd say the 2nd and 14th Amendment need to get looked at. First Amendment is the construction of the government. Now, this was designed basically to fail, and it's failing badly. Now, in a parliamentary system, which is what the rest of England bequeathed its colonies, who had some sense, a parliamentary system. In such a parliamentary system, you have a government, and they have policies. If the policy is not popular, and there's a vote in government, then you have a vote of confidence. And then that's it. The government goes and you have an election. You really don't have this continual stalemate that goes on, such as this system. So I think step back and take a good look at that. Is it really working? Second Amendment, of course, gun control. I mean, this massacre that goes on. Imagine there's massacre on the roads every day with dead squirrels and whatnot, but we're talking about human massacre. And you've got the 14th Amendment where corporations are people, sanctified by the Constitution. When corporations were instituted by the state control, their power, the state's really worried about their power, what they can do. And rightly so. And I think that needs to get looked at again. That's my discussion tonight. I would recommend my book to you guys. I wrote several years ago. Can be found on Amazon. Titled Sabotaging America. It's a jolly good read, and I recommend it. I don't come here to sell it, I just recommend it. It goes over a lot more. It talks about economics, talks about the cozy money club and globalization and so on. So it's quite a good. I recommend it anyway. 15, something like 12. I don't, anyway, that's it. And thank you for your attention.
Before you take questions, we'd like to present you with a little certificate of appreciation of you taking your time to spend with us. And
thank you.
Hope you can find a frame and a place on your wall for it.
Well, as I say, my wife thanks you, because instead of me boring her to death, I can come and bore you, Chuck.
And before I recognize questioners, let me remind everybody that 2 weeks from tonight, on the 22nd, we will have Professor Robert Wood from the University of Dallas speaking on Plato's treatment of justice in a Christian worldview. So, if you're interested in Plato, come back in 2 weeks. So, there's a question. Or if you have any questions, Jack, I need to ask you. So, I actually have like 20 questions, but I'll have to start with the first one.
You can have 20.
Thank you. It seems like the information that you convey to us tonight is out there in the public domain, and that it should be available to people everywhere. And yet, especially amongst the 99%ers, we still have some percentage of that group that are what I call the denialists about, or they just don't know. And so
getting to the question is about, I saw an article in one of the major newspapers this week that said it's not Washington, it's America. And the implication being we keep re-electing the same people who are perpetuating the situation that you so eloquently described. And do you think this is, what role would education play in addressing that particular phenomenon?
Well, it is a matter of education, really. It's because I think education should make you curious. Education should make you want to know more. For example, you know, when I came, I didn't know much about America. You know, I had some preconceived views. So, you know, I did a forensic study, if you want. But I think most Americans live in an insulated world. They sort of take America as it's presented to them, without really questioning things. Well, why is this going on? Why are the politicians doing this or that or the other? So you're saying, well, why? Because, I mean, frankly, I'm somewhat apolitical. I don't think either party has solutions. Certainly in England, we basically have, I think, four parties now, basically all very similar. And they're not really addressing the problems. And I've offered up some solutions, but you know, I'm not dogmatic. I mean, you know, as a scientist, as you know, in science you offer up a theory and you test it against reality. And after a while, if reality negates your theory, then you say, okay, we'll change the theory. So that's my attitude, basically, is let's be pragmatic. Let's see what works. Let's question things. I think, you know, you ask me why don't people demand more from their politicians? Well, as I basically said earlier, we have the best democracy money can buy. Many people are apathetic. They realize that, see, in England, under a parliamentary system, elections last about 4 or 5 weeks. And they elect the whole gang. I mean, you don't have a presidential election that basically goes on for, what, 18 months? And you have these cardboard cutout figures that are paraded before you. Basically, most of them really are unfit to govern anything. They're just not trained. No, they're not trained for it. Now in Oxford, as I mentioned to you, the chap I sat next to, in England, if you wanted to go into politics, you go to Oxford and you do PPE, which stands for Politics, Philosophy, and Economics. So you have some training in governance. You know, it's a mystery. Now, my wife would say, well, the media dumbs down the public. And that's done deliberately. That's her philosophy. And perhaps that's true. You know, up until when Reagan came in, there used to be fair and balanced media. But he changed that. So you have, of course, you
got Rupert Murdoch now.
a man who's had allegiances to three different countries in his life, so his only allegiance basically is to the bottom line, which is okay, but should never have this degree of influence, really. But when you feed, you see, many things are counterintuitive in this way. Economics is basically somewhat counterintuitive. So it's so things that on face value seem easy to understand are basically the wrong way to go. for example, now we have, you know, we're going to have austerity, and that will make us rich. Well, you know, that won't make us rich, it will make us poorer. As I said, we needed to spend some money to get out of this recession, not reduce spending. That was the Keynesian prescription. And so, I don't know the answer about waking up the public. But I mean, I agree with you. Most people, I think, most Americans are honest, hardworking people, are patriots, want to see their country succeed. And, you know, I grew up in a country that in fact was crippled by the Bretton Woods Agreement all the way through the 50s and 60s. That's another lecture. I know what it feels like to grow up in a country that's in decline. Now, if it goes on as it's going, America will have that same feeling. So, my take was, we needed, instead of getting Obama, we needed Franklin Delano Roosevelt back. That's really who we need. That's in my opinion.
Question over here.
Remember the Puritans?
Sorry? The Puritans?
The Puritans, yes. They were drummed out of Britain because they were capitalists at a time when Britain was more capitalist, meaning the entire wealth was tied up in land, and the landowner had a strict hierarchy, as did the entire country based on the land ownership. So the capitalists were squeezed out. They went to a small place called New England, and they started developing the capitalism.
Yes.
And Britain remained a mercantilist country until 1960s, when a very funny thing happened. One, Britain lost its mercantilist standing, and number two, the multinational corporations learned about mercantilism just about the same time.
So they went back to it.
Yes, and corporations have been operating as mercantilists since the global years of 1960.
Well, 1980, but according to my definition, but you may be right. I want quibble.
And at the same time, some of the young and ambitious went to Oxford PPE, and there they learned that it was better to keep the population ignorant so that they could get away with anything they wished to do. Now, if education can be corrupted in such a way, or the results of education can be used for corruption, what is your solution?
I think anything can be corrupted, as I said. All the institutions that support the capitalist system has been corrupted. Certainly education can be corrupted. But as our discussion before, such corruption will inevitably lead to disaster, actually. It is not economically sound to have a misled public, actually. Because I was a manager in Xerox, with quite a few hundred people working for me at one point. I used to start off a new project. I'd say to the guys, look, we are a team. We're going to fall or die by our success. Don't expect me to know everything, be perfect, because I'm not. I wouldn't expect you to be perfect, because you're not. But we're going to work together, and if there's a problem, come and see me, and we'll fix it. But if you lie to me, then I'll kick you out. So we need the fullest amount of information, and we need transparency. And that basically, that's one of the problems of the hierarchical system. Bad news is not accepted as it goes up the chain. You get a series of lies going up the chain. When you, you know, I produced, you know, I was hired to do computer printing in Xerox. Before that, it was Handfall. So I was the manager. The first product that was a single 8.5 by 11. It made several million dollars for Xerox. So when there was a problem, they put John on there. but you can only succeed. So certainly, engineering is a nice profession because even Granny can tell if you switch on the TV, it doesn't work. So the products must work. You know, they must be good. So you must have transparency. Now, this works in all professions, really. You can't have a non-ethical, non-transparent system. It's not going to be economically viable. So all I can tell you is that you must operate to the highest ethical and moral standards.
Who is going to reinforce it?
Well, you could say that the economic system will enforce it, because if you don't, then you'll have this crash as we had in 2008, when people run amok. Now, I think that when you start praising money as a goal in itself, obviously everyone, money is the mechanism of exchange and so on, but you cannot have an ethos that says money is, and the profit, but the bottom line profit is the end all thing, the all and end all. You know, you must, and I think this is what has been lost. I mean, yes, the Puritans ran away and became capitalists, but at least they had moral values, I hope. Right? You know, at least they told right from wrong. They didn't say, go around and cheat your neighbor as much as possible. So there does have to be some bottom line morality in this world. You do have to give everybody a fair break. And if you don't, then you're going to have an economic collapse. And I think that's what we've seen. We've not only seen an ethical lapse, but a moral lapse. And I think that's what's happened, in my humble judgment. Next.
You've mentioned that many people think Washington is broken, and many people don't bother to vote because of the gerrymandering in the districts of both parties, so a politician's re-election is virtually guaranteed. And yes. Australia was faced with a similar problem of voters falling for the tragedy of the Commons, that their vote doesn't matter in the 1920s. And in 1924, they instituted mandatory voting in Australia with minor fines. It starts out minor if you don't vote. Should the United States do something similar to that?
You know, it's a thought.
It never fails. I'm just curious what you thought.
Well, only unless they read the legal, women voters, outlines of the policies. I think if you want, you could say that we the people get the government, we deserve, that you could say that. And what is the solution? Well, it is education, really. That's the only answer. I think the problem really is that many of these policies, as I say, aren't intuitive, and they have to be explained, and that takes time and effort. And as I say, my mythical Joe Sixpack would rather down a bud and look at maybe the night football or some Monday night football than listen to a boring dissertation on the on the money supply and blah, blah, blah. If he only understood. Most people actually do not understand how the money supply operates in this country. If you ask them how the interest rates control the money supply, they couldn't answer. If you ask them how the original gold standard worked, so you couldn't explain that either. I mean, it's not taught properly, even though... So, it does boil down to public awareness and education. But I think, what Robert Skidelsky has said, who's the barber for Keynes, by the way, very interesting 3-volume work, which I would recommend, he said there's going to have to be 2 more big crashes before the public wake up. Yeah. So perhaps that's what's going to have to happen. But I hate to see it. I hate to see it.
I was wondering, are you familiar with the Mackey book, the chairman CEO of Whole Foods, the, what he calls it, conscious capitalism? Are you familiar with that book? He covers a lot of stuff like you're talking about. Have you read that or
No, I haven't.
My God. You haven't touched on taxation. You've spoken of the benefits of increased government spending to promote job growth and education. What are your thoughts about taxation? Because you know that's quite a hot button issue.
Well, nobody likes paying taxes. In fact, that's what led to the Peasants' Revolt in the 12th and 14th century. And brought down kings. I think people are prepared to pay taxes if they can see it coming back to them. I think politicians in general do a very bad job explaining, where the tax money goes and why it's necessary. I think if people think that, look, for example, if a road has a pothole in it and your car's suspension gets wrecked because you fell into this pothole, the first thing they're going to do is call up the city and say, fix this pothole. And if the reply comes back, well, we don't have the money. So I think if... Again, it's public awareness and the pop. See, what goes around comes around. If you want a proper government, if you want proper infrastructure, you have to pay for it. Now, everybody understands that intuitively. But I think in general, it's not, this transaction, if you like, is not explained well. Why the government should spend money in a recession is not explained. They believe that you, just like a family, if you haven't got the money, if you're in a recession, you cut spending. Well, that will exacerbate the recession. It won't cure it. So these policies are never properly explained. So yes, there is a role for government. Yes, it should help people, if it's my judgment, and it should have a role in business startups. It's by this National Development Bank. So yes, you have to pay for that. Now, America basically squandered, one of my wife's favorite terms, squandering our resources. I think America squandered its resources, really. Misspent. God, vastly. The reason I got interested in economics is because in 1959, Andrew Schoenfeld, who was the economic editor of the Observer newspaper in London, wrote a book called British Economic Policy Since the War. And basically he said that Britain is not investing enough in itself. For its businesses and so on. And I think that's what America needs to understand, that investment comes from private companies, but also certain things can only come from the government. But what's not properly explained is why you need to spend it. Why you need to spend it on proper infrastructure, proper roads, proper water supplies, and so on. I mean, curiously enough, Dallas is more socialistic than England is. I mean, Dallas owns its own water supply, and we fund DART by higher taxes. Well, in England and London, water supply is owned by the Germans, and goodness knows who owns the public transport, certainly not the state. The railways are owned by the next highest bidder. But anyway, yeah, I think taxes, I think people recognize that they have to pay. I mean, when they realize they have to pay money for food, well, you need other things. You need the light turned on. You need the country defended. But it's not properly explained as to why. You know, where are we spending the money? What are we spending it on? But, you know, when we have 20 million unemployed, you know, as I said before, we say we can't afford to do this. We can't afford to do that. But we can afford to have 20 million unemployed. I mean, it's an economic nonsense. We have to get people, have to get Americans back to work. I mean, that's what we should have done.
Thanks very much for your respectful explanation of the economic situation we're in now. I'm British. I was terribly disappointed when Tony Blair came in and said he was going to carry on with the policies of Thatcherism. He said we needed a change of face, not a change of policy. So we saw massive pilfering of our public resources there. This seems to be, you're quite right, the situation that America is going into. I'm really worried about your national parks, for example, at present. We've seen Tony Blair's personal wealth increase from very, very dark sources that can't be explored. I wonder, in terms of stimulus, we've seen time and again that the stimulus is needed under these situations, and it's being blocked by the government here. But my question is, in relationship to this, we see these problems, but haven't the problems passed beyond our control? Haven't they passed beyond government control? Aren't we in a situation, perhaps, where there is no possibility for collective action anymore? It's gone out of democratic control into the hands of the corporations, and with that, the 1%. Where is my Serviam now? I don't think there is a possibility for it. I like the fact that you explored the issue and you suggested there's a possible happy ending. I'm not sure.
Well, I'm an engineer, you know, scientist engineer by training. So I, as I said, when there was a problem in Xerox, they came to John and he put in charge of things, and by and large, we fixed it. So this problem is man-made and can be fixed. Now, it is a question of political will. As I said right at the beginning, the economic system is a man-made construct. It's not set in stone. And so, now, I did say that, I mentioned that Skidelsky said, well, there's going to have to be two major crashes, before the penny drops and something gets done. Now, yes, I think Tony Blair was a charlatan. I think Gordon Brown was a simpleton. Both really should have no place in government. I mean, they were unfitted, really. So, you know, I'm not saying, you mentioned that the British system is wonderful and marvelous. It isn't. I already said that the mechanism of getting rid of governments is somewhat easier, faster. The problem is to select the right people, you know, in the hour of need. Now, we've seen that. We've seen FDR appear. We saw Churchill appear. We have seen great people appear. And, you know, that's what we need. We need somebody with some stature to get up and shake the country by its collar and say, look, country, this is what we need to do. Now, right or wrong, we best do something. And I've given you what I would do. But as I say, once again, I'm so sorry for the young people, both in England and here. They've been given a raw deal.
Thank you very much for your talk. I agree with absolutely everything you had to say. Fabulous, fabulous. Right down to we will be better served by a parliament. So let me ask a question related to Lord Kane's recommendation to Bretton Woods. I think you called it Bancor
is one word.
C-O-R-P or C-O-R-E?
No.
C-O-R.
B, yeah, B-A-N-C-O-R. See, bank for banks and or gold. So
could you recommend a book on that, and could you explain again how that would help a balance of trade?
A book is really, the book would be Robert Skidelsky's book on Kings, but let me go over it. Say you have this trade imbalance with China, which we have. So it's because, of course, the American dollar is a much higher value than the renminbi. So it's much cheaper to make items in China than it is in the USA. So at the end of the year, we look at the balance of payments, and we say, okay, so what Keynes would do was to lower the value of the dollar by 5% and raise the value of the renminbi via this Bancor currency, which is an intermediary. So gradually, year after year, this imbalance would even out. So it would not be profitable to manufacture stuff in China anymore.
So this is a synthetic currency with like a central bank?
Yeah, that was his thesis was that was what the IMF would do. It would actually balance internationally, or balance out the trade internationally, because before the war, sort of Second World War, you had this competitive devaluations, where everyone's lowering the value of their currency, so nobody wins. And you do want trade, but you must have balanced trade.
Okay,
does that explain it?
Yeah, thanks. We have to make this one the last question. I've recognized two others, but we've got to call time. So probably it's the last question.
You mentioned two possibilities of things which are fundamentally the cause of this. One was education, and the other one was morality. Now, what I know is morality overall inclusive, and is it overall effective, or is it just a matter of the times we're in and so forth? And is the other one, the education, if you had education without morality, would it survive?
I think, it's basically, of course, you take Hitler's Germany, you had education, but you had a terrible morality, basically, under the Nazis. I mean, you had evil rampant, and yet you had tremendous scientific achievements. I mean, when London was subject to interballistic missiles by the end of the war, there was no defense against them. So I think, candidly, morality must be a prime concern. Education by itself won't suffice, because it can be turned to very, very dark ends. So I think morality, the way you treat people, your conduct, your integrity, is fundamental. Fundamental.
Okay.